It's really quite astonishing when you think about it in the life of Jesus, which all of which was divinely ordained. None of it happened just randomly or happened because of any egoic need of his own. He was a fully self-realized master. He had no karma when he was born. There was sufficient ego identification to be able to operate, create and operate one body. But there was no unlearned lesson in Jesus himself. That is the nature of an avatar. It's a whole discussion to describe what that's like. But suffice to say, Jesus was a Christ. Yogananda and the other masters pictured behind me are all of the same ilk. And from Yogananda's life, also described in Autobiography of a Yogi, we have a picture both of what a master's consciousness really is in a cosmic sense, and also how that drama plays out when they're incarnated and they live among us. So we have Jesus at that point went off into the wilderness and was tested by Satan, tested by the devil. And you just think it's very confusing. Either he was free or he wasn't free. Either he had desires or he didn't have desires. And if he didn't have desires of his own, how could he be tested by the devil? And what is this devil anyway? I mean, this whole reading is one that many people who come to a sanctuary like ours are hoping never to hear again. You know, we don't really want to be hearing about the devil being out to get you and all the dark forces and what they're trying to do to you. And that was and you know, how sinful we are and all these other things. We're trying to escape from all of that, not merely escape from it, but repudiate it. But yet here, right in the scripture, Jesus goes out and is tested by the devil. Darn it. You know, it's very annoying, what to speak of confusing. So we have to understand, first of all, that the life of a master is not lived for himself. It is a conscious role that the master takes in order to teach us. As I've talked about it in other contexts, it's like all of us are imprisoned for crimes we actually committed. And those crimes we actually committed are a desire to find happiness through temporary means, and to that extent, refuse to accept the unconditional bliss that is our true birthright, because we're going to cling to this little thing right here. You know, sometimes children become more infatuated with the package that the toy comes in than the toy itself. And sometimes the children aren't wrong in that respect, but their point of view is just dictated by the limits of their understanding. And that's all there is to it. I recall being in an educational toy store. I think it was somewhere in Texas, but it doesn't matter where. And this mother had gone in and picked out some things that she wanted her 3-year-old son to have. But she did not keep an eye on him while she was picking out his toys, and he was just calmly picking out his own. And of course, he had no concept of what he was picking out. He was picking it by the wrapper, by the shape, by its position on the shelf, who knows. And she was a very efficient mother doing lots of things, and she was ready to check out, and she had these nice gifts for him, but he had his own. And of course, what he picked out, she didn't think was suitable, and she was going to have to get it out of his little hands, you know, and put it back on the shelf before she could leave that store. And being a modern mother, she wasn't going to try to reason with him and work with him and shift his energy. And she was trying to attract him to the one that she had over here, holding it out, you know, showing him how interesting it was. And he's holding his very tightly to his chest, recognizing the threat that's implied here. But he's also becoming drawn into what she has. And she almost made it, you know, because he was beginning to loosen his grip over here. And he was just about to reach out when she became impatient and she took it away from him. Oh, big mistake. Wrapped his arms both around it. They get into a tug of war. You know, he's screaming and crying by this time. And finally, there's nothing to do except say, I'm bigger and stronger than you, and I can pry your little hands off of this box, which he was reduced to doing, you know. I mean, that's the game we play. Our Divine Mother is trying to attract us to one thing, and whatever we're attracted to, we're holding on to it. And what happens to us is either we lose it or we get to keep it. But what happens to us is we don't get the bigger lesson. We don't get the bigger opportunity. You know, the Divine Mother is not trying to hurt us. Divine Mother is ultimately wise. Mothers are well-intentioned, some of them are wiser than others. Divine Mother is ultimately wise. She really knows where our happiness is, but we have found our own toys based on what we can see and what we think of as attractive. We can't read all this fine print. Some of it isn't even visible to the human eye, and we don't understand the implications of what she's chosen. Now, the Master's come into this world, and this is the crime of which we are guilty. We have desired to live and identify with our human body and with our ego. Our ego is our identification with this human body, our identification with the physical sensations that come through it, our identification with the world perceived through the senses as an outward reality, and all that that implies, which, if you stop and contemplate it, is huge. Okay? And so all that that implies is who we think we are. And that brings us, that reincarnates us literally, back into a physical body, back into a circumstance that is reflective of who we are and what we want and what we think will make us happy. And we are imprisoned by that. We are imprisoned by it simply because we cannot perceive beyond our level of consciousness, and we cannot perceive except through our physical body if we are so deeply identified with it that we are out of touch with our superconscious self. And we have to just serve our sentence. And our sentence is long or short. The path has no distance. It's just entirely based on the sincerity of our efforts and the intensity of our concentration. Now, a self-realized master, as I've often explained in here, is someone just like us, but he's been through it all. He's played with every single toy there was in the toy store, and he's finally realized that there's something beyond all of that. Fully realized that from his own experience. And most of the time, when a soul finally finishes this long journey away from his home in God and returned, he's just so happy to be there. The bubble merges into the ocean and it never comes out again. But there are souls who have so much compassion for all the rest of us that they willingly choose, by no compulsion, but accept the desire to serve, to accept a physical body and live in this prison with us. And what they demonstrate to us, what they explain to us, is how we can be happy here, where our true happiness lies, what the real purpose of this life is, and where we are going. And that would be no example at all if they didn't act out the experiences that all of us are facing. So in Yogananda's Autobiography of a Yogi, you have a fully realized master who could go into cosmic consciousness at any point, but he is put on the role of being a young man seeking God. And so he shows us, by the intensity of his dedication and by his determination and by his willpower in meditation and by his desire for a guru, and then by his dedication to the guidance of that guru and the picture we have of life in the ashram and as the way in which Sri Yukteswar, his guru, works with what Yogananda describes as his limitations, we see the example. And is the master play-acting? Is he not play-acting? When Swami Kriyananda asked Yogananda that question, he said, well, it's a little bit, this is the image, it's a little bit like going to see a movie for the second time, where you actually know what's going to happen, but you don't spend the whole time thinking about what you know. You just enter into the flow and you let the drama unfold. But as Master put it, he said, inwardly, you are always free. So no matter what swirls around you, what betrayals, what disappointments, what's hard work, what's suffering, all of these different things that actually happen, there's always another level where the Master knows, just very much like an actor on the stage. I remember years ago when our school was much smaller and our children were younger. We often had adults play parts in the play. There were other good reasons for it, which we've relinquished in favor of letting junior high school kids have the lead roles. But it made it more dynamic for the children to have adult actors on the stage, because the adults were able to dedicate themselves to the roles, often in the way children couldn't quite do. So all the children had to respond to a much more dynamic energy. But nonetheless, I was in a couple of those plays, and once I played for a while, I played the part of Jesus's mother. I got to play Mary, and then another smaller person took over the role for the rest of the play. But Gary was Joseph in that case, and Matthew was Jesus. Matthew was one of our teachers and a professional actor. I mean, he was trained as a professional actor. He's very good. And there was one moment in that play that still, this was years ago, that's so vivid to my mind. We had Joseph die in our version of the play, because in the Bible, Joseph just kind of vaporizes. And that's just a little hard for the children. So we had a scene in which Joseph dies. So Joseph, which is Gary, is stretched out on the bier, whatever it is. He's stretched out like this. And then I'm the part of Mary, and I'm supposed to be, here's my dead husband, you know. This is a real thing. And I just, you know, I like to act, I enjoy it, and it was fun to play the part. And I just really put myself into what it would be like, you know, to see David or a husband, any husband, just dead there. And I vividly remember feeling, and I just did that. And I knew what was going to come next, but I took it completely out of my mind. What was going to come next is that Matthew, playing the part of my son, pulls me away from there. But instead of relating to any of that, I just related to the fact that there he was, and he was dead, and I was just there. And I remember Matthew, who's a big man, I still feel he pulled, got my shoulders, and he just lifted me and just carried me off of there. But nothing in me cooperated with him. Everything in me just kept going forward, and he had to take me back. You know, it's just a tiny moment in a play, but I can still feel the reality of that whole experience. Now, there was no point at which he couldn't have poked me and said, you know, this is Gary, and he's not my husband, and he's not dead, you know. But still, you can enter into it so deeply, and you enter into it for the beauty of human feeling. You know, that's sort of an odd thing to say, because it was grief. It wasn't love, it wasn't bliss, but there's something so, it was love, but it wasn't bliss, but there's something so magnetic about the capacity to feel, about the capacity to experience, and how sweetly and deeply the divine moves through all of that. So when the masters enter this world, they're not play acting. I mean, it's not play acting to know that this is ephemeral, because they live by their own reality entirely and completely in the eternal now. And if we're living in the eternal now, whatever little thing is happening is happening. The way Swamiji describes it, he said, to live in the now is to live in, but not for, the present moment. You see the difference? We think somehow that to be spiritual is to be a little bit withdrawn. You know, not quite open our hearts, not quite really care, not quite really commit ourselves. Because after all, we're yogis, you know, we shouldn't be doing those things. But that's not the picture that the master really gives us. We have Paramhansa Yogananda there, who has been a fully self-realized master for, you know, for thousands of years, really, literally. And still, he's crying for Krishna's vision. He's crying for Divine Mother. And he tells us the story in the autobiography of hour after hour, just beseeching God to come to him. When it was time for him to, when he got the call to come to America from India, and he had to leave India. He refused to go until he had the verification from the divine that this was the right thing to do. And he describes how passionately he called to God. And finally, there was a knock on his meditation room door. And he opens the door, and Babaji appears to him. When you go to Yogananda's house in Calcutta, they'll take you to the room where Master was meditating. And the door that opened, and Babaji was on the other side. It's quite impressive to stand there, you know, and feel and hear that. Because he wasn't living for that moment, but he was completely in that moment. So when Jesus incarnates in a human body and has to live the life that human beings live, it's the part that he's been given. And during the time that he's playing that part, there is no other reality because this is the now. And part of what happens in human life is these incredible conflicts strike us. And Swami's saying, you know, people say it's just within our own minds. And yes, those conflicts register in the chakras and they become part of the magnetic pattern that causes us to be who we are. But the important point we have to understand here, and it cannot be overemphasized, is that we are, as Ishani was singing today, we are just an empty vessel. We are just a pattern of energy. We are literally a radio receiving station. We are a window through which the light of spirit shines, any image that you want to have. And then there are these cosmic forces. We are not an isolated reality. This is the delusion that the ego persuades us of. This is ego, the infinite spirit, the bubble of the ocean, the jiva, which is me, identifies with this little material reality. It gives me one culture, one gender, one set of eyes, one physical location. And we actually think that's what's really happening. And then even worse, we tend to think that everything about me is generated by me. And a lot of sort of close but not quite right on the mark teachings really sort of tell us more and more about how we're supposed to be powerful in ourselves, and I am this and I am that and I can do this. Swamiji spoke recently and something, wrote something. He says, I think this whole movement of self-esteem, although well-intentioned, is misguided. He said, there's no self-esteem. There's no self to have esteem. The real esteem that we want to have is the realization that I am but an empty vessel. And what we really want to do is use that willpower, which is God-given, and that personal force, which all of us sense within us and in powerful moments really have, to receive the correct vibrations because happiness producing, that's all that we're working with. And this is the revolution. The revolution is that our nature is bliss. And we are moving away from sin and all of those ideas. But if we move away from the idea that there are two opposing forces, we condemn ourselves, well, to mediocrity. Because if we just imagine that we can just, that there's nothing opposing us and we can just float, then we will just float. And that true destination that our souls are longing to achieve will never come to us. So even Jesus goes out and is tempted of the devil, because there is always, and we all feel it, this force that's trying to pull us away from our own true happiness. And it's just habit. It's just wrong understanding. It's just the childish choosing of what's already at our level and not even having the capacity to look up. You know, children are so extremely short. I'm sure you've noticed that about them. You know, and it's just a problem, they're being so short. I was in a sporting goods store. I don't know who this child was. I wish I had gotten his name and address so I could go find him later. He was a short person, you know. He was probably about 2 or maybe 3. And he had a companion, a stuffed animal companion, that was an elephant, I think it was, or a monkey. No, it wasn't a monkey. I think it was an elephant. And he carried it with a certain dignity that was unusual in a child. He was one of those children who really thinks he's about 70 still. And so he walked like a child and he looked like a child, but his consciousness was very much of a dignified man, probably an artist, although he seemed a little wealthy at the age of 3. And he's just sort of carrying on this whole experience. And his mother was also an extremely interesting woman. They were really quite a pair. And they were dealing with something in the sporting goods store, and the sporting goods store had a high, solid counter like this. And the main thing I remember about this poor child was he spent the whole time like this, just sort of right up against this huge counter, looking up, trying to guess what was happening over the top, which somehow was of great importance to him. The details escape me, but some extremely important negotiation was going on between his mother and the clerk that was going to affect the happiness of the child. And all he could deal with was this big blank wall and this effort to look over it, you know? But in the mother-child relationship, which was an exceptionally dear one, I mean, these are, you know, people who just cross your life and then go away. The comfort here is, there's a quotation from Lord Buddha, which is very interesting. He said, the reason you should be kind to everyone in the world is because in one incarnation or another, you have been close with every other person. Every time I think about that mother and her child, I think, well, they must have been my very dear friends in some life. And we just had, you know, 1 minute in the store and then they went away. But nonetheless, what you see there, what I was trying to say about that is that the child trusted his mother, but he didn't have any idea what was going on. Now, when we live in our lives, we're always having these dual forces. We're always trying to think it out for ourselves, which is appropriate. But there comes a point in our spiritual life where the greater part of wisdom, and the word for it is humility. We have humility in the face of the fact that this creation is obviously much vaster than my little ego mind can grasp. And that's what brings us to a place like this. Because we want to be always asking the question, not just what do I think is real, what does everybody around me say, what is common wisdom? We want to actually ask, what is really happening here? And ever and again, through your awakened sons, the answer comes. That's what we say in the Festival of Light. The reason we repeat those words in these rituals over and over again is because there is an infinity of implied wisdom in each of those phrases. Ever and again, through your answered sons, through your awakened sons, the answer comes. And what happens to Jesus, one of the awakened sons? He goes out and he's tempted of the devil. And he has to embrace his faith and his understanding of the divine presence, even in the face of this very convincing evidence and all this seductive reasoning and all this attractiveness that comes from just sort of just going just a little bit this way. Even in the oratorio that Swami Kriyananda wrote about the life of Christ, that one of the songs is this exquisite quartet, which is Jesus being tempted of Satan. And the singers do not wear little signs. I'm the devil. I'm not the devil. And the devil starts, and the devil has a bass voice, naturally. You know, opera singers who have bass voices. We know one opera singer came to Swamiji. An alto woman spoke to him once. A bass man said, you know, I always have to play the villain. That's my voice. That's my vocal range. The villain is rarely the tenor. The villain is almost always the bass. And Master said, Swamiji advised both of them. He said, well, just feel that you're just being God's instrument in all of that. And you're just living this out to the end so that you can repudiate it forever. You know, live it as God lives it. See it as just the force of that dark energy isn't so that the light can shine even more beautifully. You know, play the part, God's part in that way. So in that song, when Satan starts singing, Satan does seems very reasonable. He just says, worship me. You know, everything that you want, all these things that you desire, you can have it all. Just worship me. And you think, well, maybe this is God's voice. God could also sing in a bass register too, you know. And then Jesus comes in, get thee behind me. You know, Jesus replied, and the famous get thee behind me, Satan comes to mind. So on the wrong side here. But it's actually very effective because you just get right drawn in. Why not? Worship me means to put at the center of your altar your ego, your physical body, its pleasures, the limited identification that you have now. Worship that. Why not? Because then you can have all of that. Well, yes, you can. So it just becomes a question of our own intuitive feeling of whether that is really the bliss we are seeking or whether there is more, whether there is more. And we have to be constantly vigilant in this because our old habits, and even this is where the awakened sons answer us. Yogananda writes at the end of this reading, I used to think that Satan was a myth. I used to think that there was no force like this, but by my own experience, I know that it exists. It's a vibration emanating from the cosmos to keep us moving outward. And if we want to go back inward and upward to the spirit, we have to exert that will to do it. And now, in another expanded commentary on this, Swamiji expresses very strongly what kind of self-effort is required. And this is a very important key in this. He said, this is what we need. This is the kind of self-effort that's required. First, to focus our full concentration on God, on the fact of God's presence. And even if we lose contact with it, as we all do in a forgetful way, either by just sheer vagueness of mind or by becoming distracted, we imagine for a time that this is our only reality. Oh, my body has received a serious cancer diagnosis, and all of a sudden I'm in a panic about this. Somebody I really love has died, and now I feel abandoned. Some endlessly difficult karmic condition of my own just keeps coming up and up and up. And we just forget for a moment. We concentrate on those realities and we forget that that is happening in the context of infinity. That whatever that is happening in the context of Divine Mother trying to let go of what we've chosen for ourselves so she can give us that which she knows will really draw us to where we're trying to be, where our true happiness lies, that we must always keep our focus on the divine. And when you lose your focus, you just bring it back. Nothing more is required. Just bring it back again and again. Incarnation after incarnation, bring it back. Just keep bringing it back to the idea that I am part of the infinite whole. I am a part of all that is. My true father, my true mother are infinity. Like that brother at SRF who's, when Ronald Reagan's daughter went to his church and Ronald Reagan was president, she introduced herself to him. Hello, I'm, whatever her name was, my father is president of the United States. He said, I am Brother Turiananda. My father is Lord of the Universe. Just like that. You see, that's where we want to be at all times. Once Swami Kriyananda said to Yogananda, just in conversation, my father. And Yogananda said, you have no father but God. He wouldn't even let him finish his sentence. Swami said, my father, master said, you have no father but God. And so Swami said, excuse me, sir, my earthly father. That's all. When Yogananda's own father criticized his guru, Sri Yukteswar, criticized Yogananda's guru, Sri Yukteswar, Yogananda looked his father in the face and he said, earthly birth, physical birth is something, but divine birth is everything. If you say one more word against my guru, I disown you as my father forever. That's pretty harsh on one level, but he was keeping his focus always on God. If you oppose my guru, I have no further use for you. You must respect the one reality in the world. First, keep your focus on God. Second, offer to God your wholehearted devotion. Do not put anything else on your altar but the divine. This is the true meaning of the commandment, thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not worship idols. It's not really about whether you make a little murti, whether you make a little statue of Jesus, a statue of Krishna. These are God reminding pictures on the altar. They're God reminding, but nobody's worshiping the picture. We're worshiping what's represented behind it. But what do we really put on our altars? Our youth, our beauty, our cars, our homes, our IRAs, our, you know, whatever it might be, we put on our altar and we worship it because our whole life rotates around it. Our life must rotate only on God. Keep your focus on God. Offer the divine your wholehearted devotion. Yes, Lord, I make endless mistakes, I forget, but in the end, I will come back and I will stand with you. That's number two. The third, you must have faith in God's unconditional love for you. Isn't that just marvelous? This is self-effort. It's not to feed the poor. It's not to give away millions of dollars, although that doesn't hurt. All those things are good things to do. Why not? Because they help expand our sense of identity from the little self to the infinite self. But that is not what God is looking for. I mean, what does he care? You put $100 in the collection plate, as Ramakrishna said. He already was that $100 before you even put it in the collection plate. He enabled you to earn it. He put it in your wallet, and you think it's a big deal to give it back. You know, what God wants from you is faith in his unconditional love. Because you see, everything follows from that. Because if you believe that God loves you, if you know that God loves you, then everything that happens to you is an expression of that love. And that's everything. You know, stumble, fail, succeed, make a mess, who cares? Keep your focus on God. Offer him your wholehearted devotion and have faith in his unconditional love for you. God bless.